The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
Well, now it's time to talk to Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin, who joins us this morning via Skype. Luke, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How's it going?
It's going very well. Now, a few things. Last night there was a report which I saw on, I think it was CNN, that the Russians will be starting mass vaccinations in October of their population.
Yeah, isn't it incredible, Pat? This is the Sputnik one we discussed last week, in a way, isn't it? Where they seem to have got their, the claim they got there first with a really efficacious vaccine. And we just got to wait and see, Pat. I mean, we haven't seen any data. Nothing's been published yet, sadly. But they're claiming they've got a really effective vaccine. They're claiming they gave it to all the senior political people already, kind of thing. You know, even a month ago is one rumor, you know. So they seem to have made lots of progress.
You wonder about that because it seems that in his dacha, President Putin has all sorts of protections to make sure he doesn't contract the virus. So it would be, I suppose, a very good PR coup if he could show the mark where he got the vaccine and say, I got it. And if he can get it, well, then the rest of the population too. So we'll wait for that photo op.
We will. It's political in a way, Pat. They're claiming to have beaten the Americans, you see. That's part of the agenda here, I suppose. But they're using a technology that's being used in other vaccines that are being tested in the US and in Europe, you see. So it's a really important thing to see what they're going to get from this one. In other words, nothing fancy here technologically. So it may well work. You never know. They're skipping that big safety trial is the concern, of course, which we're all worried about, you know. And Fauci said the Americans wouldn't use vaccines that hadn't gone through, you know, these safety trials. So again, there's kind of a little bit of a battle going on there.
Now, you have been looking at the vaccines which were, are under trial at the moment and the different technologies being deployed. First of all, Sanofi and GlaxoSmithKline, and they are each providing a piece of what will ultimately go into your arm.
They are. So GSK are interesting. I did work for those about 3 or 4 years ago, you may remember, so I know a lot about GSK. They have a very powerful adjuvant, which is the immune stimulus that each vaccine needs. And this adjuvant is used in other vaccines and it's pretty safe. So they've combined an adjuvant with a vaccine made by Sanofi. And the US government, Pat, have given them $2.1 billion, which is incredible, isn't it, to develop this combo. And they've already bought 100 million doses, the usual thing, you know, well ahead of time. So suddenly GSK and Sanofi now are stepping up. And as we know already, many other companies are there as well. But this combination now looks especially interesting because you need an adjuvant. It's a, sort of like jump leads for your car, Pat, to jump the immune system to get it to go right. And GSK have a very powerful adjuvant. So again, there's optimism and a new, another option, basically, that will be different, say, to some of the rival vaccine manufacturers.
And does this adjuvant work all the time, you know, no matter what the infection is? Is it just a stimulant, like putting electrodes on your heart and getting it to jump when you've passed away, that it works like that for any attack on your system?
Exactly. And GSK have kind of stolen the march on other companies by getting a really powerful adjuvant for other vaccines. It's in the malaria vaccine, for example. So they've been using this adjuvant. Their limitation, Pat, is making enough of it for other vaccines. And now they're trying to get the supply chain right for this one. Because if you're going to make like hundreds of millions of doses of the vaccine, lots of this adjuvant is going to be needed. And the good news is that it's a pretty safe adjuvant that doesn't seem to have any ill effects compared to other adjuvants. So in other words, GSK have now stepped up, I guess. Now, as I say, I did work with them. So pinch of salt. There's no conflict of interest here, I assure you. But they're a very good company for developing adjuvants. And this one seems to really work, you know.
Now, the next one we're going to talk about is Inovio Pharmaceuticals, and they've been working with animals. What have they found?
Yeah, and here's another company, Inovio. And this, again, illustrates, Pat, as I said before, the frenzy of activity, all these different companies. They're a smaller company. They've got what's called a DNA vaccine. Now, you may remember Moderna have the RNA vaccine, and that's the RNA molecule that can make the spike protein in the person you inject it into. You can use DNA to make the spike protein as well. And lo and behold, Inovio are trying this DNA vaccine. So if you like, it's technology number, whatever, 10 or 11 at this stage, that's now being tested. And the good news is they've done their animal trial and it worked really well. They got a very strong antibody response, very strong T cell response. And as you know, both of those responses are needed. So again, another option, I suppose, that's there. Zenobia now are full steam ahead with this newer technology.
Now, there's another company, two companies, Pfizer and BioNTech?
They're going to produce
their own particular vaccine, and they're selling 120 million doses to Japan. How different is their vaccine?
Yeah, but again, they were given, I think, a couple of billion by the US government to develop their two companies, as you say, by collaborating. BioNTech is a German company who had the vaccine. Pfizer then began to collaborate with. Remember, Pfizer have the deep pockets and the huge resources to build this up into a huge product. And again, they were given, I think it was $2 billion as well the other week. Their technology is quite similar, actually, to the Oxford vaccine. So again, you've got a direct comparison there. And then, yeah, Japan have already bought up 120 million doses. But the Japanese, obviously, just in government, did a deal with that combination and said, we will buy off you already 120 million doses. And now off they go. That Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is now in phase three as well, just like the Oxford vaccine. So we're waiting now to see what's going to happen with that one. And yet again, the Japanese have figured, oh, that's the one we like. And it's like many countries are now saying, and the European Union, as you know, Pat, are buying up various vaccines from different companies. And the Japanese basically got to the head of the queue for the Pfizer vaccine.
Now, one of the concerns was that people who definitely had COVID-19, because they were tested at the time, perhaps they were, sick enough. So it was definitely an infection by the coronavirus. And then a couple of months later, they're tested and their level of antibody is very low. And people are saying, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, maybe a vaccine won't work then. It gives you a little bit of limited protection, but 3 weeks later, you don't have it. You say those fears are unfounded.
Yeah, that's a funny one, Pat, for us immunologists. Now, of course, the idea there would be if it was a way to show you'd had the virus, that was the first reason to measure antibodies. And that was a reasonable thing to think. Maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks out after you got better, you might be positive for antibodies. And then they began testing them and they saw them in some people and others. And lo and behold, over weeks and weeks, the antibodies went away. This then strangely caused consternation in the media. This is how the immune system is supposed to work. In other words, you have an infection, you make antibodies, you clear the virus, and then they go away because the virus is now gone. Otherwise, all your glands would be swollen. If your body was pumping out antibodies all the time, that wouldn't be a good thing. Now, the thing that people missed was, though, the antibody levels fall down, but not to zero. They fall down to what I call memory levels, and then there's enough antibody left there. When you get reinfected, then you get protected. Those low levels are hard to measure, there's a small amount of them. Even more importantly, the B cells that make them are now memory B cells. So it's no surprise to immunologists like myself that this would fall away over time, you see. But remember, that memory population may well still be there. It's just quite hard to detect, you see. And then the second thing is, the worry that a vaccine wouldn't work. Well, of course, a vaccine is a very good antibody driver. That would also cause this memory population, even more actually than a natural infection. Remember, Pat, vaccines are where science is beating nature in some ways because it really drives the immune system you want, and now you would have antibodies. So the fear that a vaccine wouldn't work was never the case, really, for this reason anyway, And now all the studies will, begin to confirm this, I guess. You can measure these memory cells. They're very hard to measure, though, so they wouldn't be used routinely. But the fact that antibodies fall away shouldn't have really concerned us.
Okay, now people will say about different conditions. If, as a child, they say, have you had measles? Yeah, you have. Well, then that's fine. You won't have to worry about getting it again. And then on the other hand, you get the common cold every year, or you get the flu, perhaps every second year. So there are some memory cells that work really well.
Yeah, that's right. That's the virus, precisely. And this is where the vaccine comes in, Pat, because strangely, the vaccine might give you much longer protection than a natural infection. So the common cold, at best, a year's protection if you have the infection, With something like measles, it's a lifetime's protection because that gives a very powerful response and a bit different to the common cold. So each virus there will differ, I suppose. And this one's in the same family as the common cold. So natural infection, at best, might give you, a few months protection, and then you might get reinfected. But of course, this is where the vaccine comes in, because the vaccine will specifically get the immune system to go really hard against one little part of the virus, and now, lo and behold, you may well see longer-term protection is the hope here. So these studies on antibodies aren't putting off the vaccine people, because they figure, look, the vaccine will actually be much stronger than a natural, without causing disease, importantly, of course, but it will give a stronger immune response that may then ultimately protect.
You've been looking at some of the drugs that have succeeded and some of those that have failed. I mean, people optimistic that some drugs would be a great treatment for COVID-19 and then it doesn't happen. And then there have been some surprises like dexamethasone, cheap as chips, and it helps at some stages of the condition.
That's right. Now, there was a disappointment about a drug called Actemra, which is used for arthritis. Actually, strangely, there's an inflammatory factor in arthritis. It's called IL-6, and this is up in COVID as well in the inflamed lungs. And then several companies did big trials with Actemra and the phase 3 trial, the one we want, about the big one. I wrote, failed, sadly. They had hundreds and hundreds of patients were given Actemra, and there was a control group, and there was no effect on pneumonia or mortality rate. There was a tiny effect on staying in hospital, but it was quite marginal. Now, that was a shame. Other studies had shown maybe a hint of something. UCD, in fact, had a study, I think, last week saying with 6 patients, there was a hint of something, you know. But that was a bit hasty because the bigger trial revealed no effect, sadly, and that combines with another company's trial called Regeneron. So, sadly, the anti-IL-6 tocilizumab approach hasn't really worked very well. But then, as you say, Pat, there's so many trials happening, and we bank on other ones. And then the dexamethasone trial was done in the UK, and that showed, you know, a third reduction in deaths for people on ventilators. So you're seeing a mixed bag to some extent. But remember, it's the usual shots on goal idea. Every sort of thing is being thrown at this. Dex gave a good result. Sadly, the Actemra anti-IL-6 didn't.
Yeah. Looking at those, what they call the recovery trials, where they have 12,000 COVID-19 patients in almost 200 hospitals across the UK, 3,000 doctors and nurses working with them, and they've been feeding in their information. And what did they find out about hydroxychloroquine?
Yes, it's remarkable, Pat, that we have to give our UK friends a big shout out, Pat, because no other country could have done this. They reckon the NHS is so well organised, at least from many people's point of view, all these hospitals coordinate, you know, so it's a massive big thing, as you say, 12,000 patients, 3,000 doctors and so on, you know. And lo and behold, they're beginning to release results. The dexamethasone result came from that recovery trial, you see. But then they tried hydroxychloroquine, again, really hard. They had nearly 5,000 people on that trial, that was giving an idea of the scale of it. And guess what? It didn't work, no benefits. Now, that, of course, was causing problems in the US, as we know, with our dear friend who was touting it, you know, and several hydroxychloroquine trials now sadly have shown no benefit in a proper placebo-controlled context, you see. So now eventually, I mean, the consensus is hydroxychloroquine is of no benefit, you see. So now that's the end, that one again gets put in the bin, I suppose, and then we carry on for other ones.
Now, questions that are coming in from Michael. Could you please ask Luke, why does he think there are so few people in our hospitals and so few deaths, although we've had quite a high number of cases recently? I mean, there was a half a dozen people in hospital and a few of those only in ICU. What's going on?
This is great. It's great news, Pat, first of all, and that question's really good. So this is not just happening in Ireland. One reason is younger people are getting infected. And remember, they have a much better course. I mean, remember, people should always not forget that 80% of people do reasonably well with this virus in terms of, you know, they get a mild enough disease, especially young people. So, of course, the demographic has now shifted. More and more, obviously, more and more young people are being infected. I think the numbers yesterday showed, I think it was 85% of the cases were under 45. Now, we know those people won't be as ill, and if they get into hospital, they won't have as difficult a course as the first reason. This is good news. And so, in other words, young people being infected, we don't want it, but it's still not too bad because these people will do well with this virus, you see. And then the second reason is, and this is more of the good news, that they're getting better at treating the patients because as doctors have got more experience, they know how to do certain things. Dexamethasone, as we mentioned, that's now standard in many hospitals they're giving patients with the more severe course. They're given dexamethasone now. And remember, if that trial is borne out, a third less deaths, that means the death rate will go down, you see. So this is extremely important for people to remember that the vaccine may still be a ways off and there's still uncertainties. The treatments are actually getting better, you see. And these numbers are borne out now with the people in hospital. So it really is a good development.
I wanted to tell you and Luke something that I thought was hilarious. My 14-year-old son said yesterday, this is from Suzanne, I said, I'm very glad the schools are reopening in September, to which he replied, Mum, they can't even keep nits out of school, so I don't know how anyone thinks they're going to keep the virus out. Here's hoping he's wrong.
Good Lord, that's very astute. Yes, that's a really good point. You know, the main reason nits happen, Pat, is lack of social distancing, isn't it? It's two heads clashing together.
Two heads together over a book, yeah.
Exactly.
So myths like the flu and the common cold will reduce if we have social distancing.
That's another benefit, precisely. Yeah, that's the way to think of it.
The reports over the weekend, this is from a listener, says up to 200 teenagers having to be broken up by the Gardaí. It's happening too often. And if you look at what they're blaming in America, Luke, for their rocketing numbers and absolutely massive numbers, it's to do with party, party, party. So are we living in a fool's paradise at the moment?
We've got to keep banging the drum, Pat, all the time. Don't go into crowds. I mean, we've said this for months, haven't we? We know this virus loves crowds. So crowds gather, young people as well, if they gather as a crowd, especially indoors, as we know, for protracted periods, the virus loves that, and it was spread through that crowd. And again, all the epidemiology confirms this. A single case, you end up with 15, 20, 30 cases from a crowded room, you see. So we've got to keep, and that's tough on our young people, of course it isn't. We've got to keep reminding them. Just try to avoid those crowds. Don't be hanging out with all these all your friends. Sadly, as it may seem, smaller numbers is okay. Outdoors is great, but small numbers outdoors, not for too long, is the message. And we've got to just keep ramming that home with.
Yeah. I mean, we're not asking people to walk over hot coals or swallow razor blades. We're just asking them to stay apart and wear a mask and wash your hands.
That's when, as time drags on, people lose compliance. And other studies in the past on pandemics have shown that people get tired and fed up and they don't believe things anymore, you know. So it's absolutely a public messaging thing, and we just got to keep saying it. Of course, you sound like a broken record after a while, I suppose. We need new ways to say these things, maybe. Get some of the celebrities to keep banging the drum as well, whatever it is, you know. Just keep saying. And that's what the WHO, the press conference yesterday, Pat, was very telling. The bottom line, we'll just keep doing what we're doing. Everybody keep doing it all as we move into the next period, really. That's essential.
Are we crazy to be letting Americans in any number, given what's going on over there, which is truly shocking?
It is horrifying. I mean, what I heard, I've got friends in America, I'm sure you do as well, and scientists are telling me they're absolutely devastated in many parts of America. They kind of put it down to American sort of society in a way where people don't care as much kind of thing, and a lot of debate on why it's spreading like wildfire. American people aren't observing the things that are being recommended to them in various ways. So, yeah, we don't want people coming into Ireland, some hot spots. For definitely, we know already we have our green countries, haven't we? But that would be a crazy thing to do, to allow people in from places in the world where the virus is running rampant. Mm-hmm. And remember, Pat, the Australian experience, did you read about Melbourne? I mean, that was a big breach of the quarantine there, which is the reason why Melbourne is now in a really bad place, you see.
There were rumours, though, that some of the security guards over these quarantine stations were having sex with some of the inmates. And they were also allowing people to go out to the shops to buy groceries. Unbelievable.
But again, that was a breakdown. I've got a friend in Australia, Melbourne, was on the phone to me yesterday. What happened there was the government subcontracted the security out to someone else. And then whoever did that didn't do a good job. The people in those security teams weren't really trained. And lo and behold, they were mixing and mingling with the people in the quarantine, you know. They were letting them out. And then those security people went home to their communities. And very often, again, it's sort of massive apartheid workers, immigrant communities, and it spread like in that community from the security workers. So it really was a misstep by the Victorian state there. And then even more worrying, that they have a curfew, and they reckon 1 in 4 people aren't staying home there. So they're sending the army now to impose the curfew, you see. So the things there are a real salutary lesson for all of us, really.
Now, in your piece in the Sunday Independent, you mentioned that there might be a case for opening smaller rural pubs versus pubs. Explain.
Yeah, I think so. But I think my opinion on this, and several people are saying this, the rural pub is a low-risk environment because the virus levels are very low in these places. The publican hopefully can control people more because he knows, or he or she knows all their locals. They will, of course, have to observe the guidelines. They can't just open freely, but small numbers of people, social distancing, if possible, an outdoor component, ventilation. It's not like an ideal environment, but the case to reopen rural pubs is quite strong, I think. Another that's a counterbalancing there, by the way, Pat. It's still risky, remember, but you're counterbalancing the community need for these places. It's essential that these places open for local communities, especially older people go there and stuff. So that kind of justifies the slight risk of it, you see. Big city pubs, forget it. I think that's still a big risk because of the alcohol, as we know, does not go well with the social distancing. It's sad. I mean, we have huge sympathy. I mean, this is the one sector that's really suffering. It's terrible, you know. So they will need to be compensated because they're being picked on, of course, and they're for good reason, for scientific reasons. But I do think that the rural pubs are a good case to reopen those.
they need to have the rules. They seem to be a bit lazy. They were lazy about, you know, making face masks mandatory, which they should do, because when you go into a shop and you're wearing your mask to protect the people you might encounter, but they're not wearing the mask to protect you. And the same with people who are serving. You want to protect them, but equally they should be wearing a mask to protect you. They seem to be lazy about laying down rules. You know, how many square feet do you need per patron in a pub? And, you know, strict rules, and the publican could tick off the boxes and say, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I can do that. No, I can't do that. I can't open. That sort of thing.
That sort of thing. Because everybody should be on board, or the publican in his or her mind should be, how can I open my pub safely? Can I comply with these things? And it's a collaboration, ultimately, isn't it? And then some people don't comply. I mean, look at Australia. There's the example we just gave. So I would imagine the internet saying, we can do it. We can open the rural pubs. We believe it's safe. We're following those guidelines. And then that makes it feasible, you see. The bigger pubs, the big crowds, that's much more difficult really to sort of monitor and police, I guess.
A final one here for the moment, Luke, and we have so many questions coming in for you, but we don't have any more time left. From Sue and Ross Trevor, could you ask Luke about how the Spanish flu ended and after how long, because there was no vaccine?
That's right, great question. It mutated, Pat. That flu virus, they mutate more quickly than the coronaviruses, which is good and bad, because they can sometimes mutate into a more dangerous form, but equally they can mutate into a less dangerous form. And lo and behold, that particular virus, luckily, now they won't look in a sense, mutated into a much less virulent form. So it became less dangerous, less toxic to people. Immunity began to build up as well. And then gradually it burnt out, which was great. They began to observe, Pat, though, things like distancing and other things even back then, you see. So those measures are being implemented as well. And that was one other reason, by the way, we think. But the main reason, we think, is it just became less virulent and then began to burn out. And now, sadly, with this one, it doesn't mutate very fast. So that doesn't seem to be an option for us. Yeah. But that was the reason why the 2019 pandemic ended.
That bad news that it doesn't mutate fast and is unlikely to burn itself out is good news for the vaccine, because once you have a vaccine, if this thing doesn't change very much, the vaccine will continue year after year to be effective.
Precisely. That's the idea. And if the vaccine is strong enough, with the right adjuvant, as we discussed, you could get years and years of immunity against this virus from a vaccine. That's a really good hope. I mean, just to mention briefly, the last one is the human papillomavirus, another HPV. That causes cervical cancer. That's a tremendous vaccine. That gives almost 100% protection. The natural infection didn't really, you know. In other words, to get herd immunity against the papillomavirus, you needed a vaccine. And we think the same is going to be with COVID-2.
Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin, thank you very much.